Okay, so this will not be a discussion about deep issues of how do you know the wave function of the universe and the measure. This is very mundane. Yes, I'm sorry, this will be incredibly, you know, practical, low level things. In the last few months, I've been kind of interested in studying large-scale structure in the mildly nonlinear regime or some nonlinear effects in the large-scale structure. This is a problem with incredibly long history, and so we'll see if much will come out of this exercise. But in any case, I wanted to tell you where it stands. Okay. Let me start with some, just to have everybody more or less pictorially in the same place. And the main motivation for doing this, it's clear that, if you're interested in understanding about the initial conditions of the Big Bang, the wave function of the universe, etc. Yes. If you want to answer the question of whether the state is unique.
Is that a picture in ABS-CFT?
Yeah.
Sometimes I changed my mind.
Then, you know, we've measured a lot of modes in the CMB, but the end appears to be near in the CMB game. For this part, I mean, we probably, there is quite a factor of a few from polarization, but and we should do it. I'm not saying that's not interesting, but we will be moving to looking at large scale structure. And the question is, one possible question will be whether you can, how much information you can actually get from large scale structure. And these now become very detailed questions and of trying to predict things in detail. And we have to see how well this can get. So I'm interested in trying to go down that path. For starters, and for this talk, I will just talk about a problem that, if you want, is a solved problem, which is a universe just made of dark matter. It's a solved problem in the computer. You can run these very beautiful n-body simulations, and the physics that goes into them is completely understood. You can solve the problem in the computer. Different people have different codes. They compare among themselves. They can figure out up to what extent, you know, the answer is already converged, et cetera, et cetera. It sounds like a solved problem. It is a solved problem. And it's an easier problem than the real problem in the universe. I understand it's an easier problem, and I'll move on to the real problem later when I understand this problem better, which will not be in this talk. But so roughly speaking, what happens is that on very large scales, the universe is quite homogeneous. You can make very simple estimates of the statistical properties of the density field using some perturbation theory. This works very well. Eventually, you go to smaller scales. It's a mess. You can calculate with a computer. You have some semi-analytic models. But it's not possible for us to take some initial conditions and get the correct phases and everything analytically of where the structures are going to be. Quickly, we lose analytical predictivity. We need to go to the computer. And the regime in between is the question, how much you can push this regime in between and gain and maybe gain some additional information from the regime in between. There'll be a point in which analytical things will not work, but it's not obvious where you have to stop. Now, the kind of questions that I think are interesting is, if you're thinking about the initial conditions, is to try to understand from what scales in the initial condition you still have information left over from in what you're looking at today. Where is this information? Is it only in the two-point function? Clearly, this field is becoming, quite non-Gaussian as you go to smaller scales. So, some of this information about the initial conditions is, and I'll give you some simple examples that you all, or the ones that think about this already, all know about, like BAO reconstruction. Things about the initial conditions are start to be encoded in higher order moments. Okay, so what information is still preserved that we can get about the initial conditions, where is this information, what is in what statistics we need to look at them, and can we push to get information for smaller scales. The gain will be that you can measure more and more modes as you go to smaller scales. So that's the hope. Now let me, as one example of these kind of problems, the other reason for the of course surveys are so important, large scale structure surveys are becoming so important in this field, is also for the study of dark energy and using the baryonic acoustic oscillations as a standard ruler to measure the expansion history of the universe. So let me spend a little bit of time talking about this. So if you there is in the matter in the distribution of matter, there is the analog of the acoustic oscillations in the cosmic microwave background. If you do the two-point function, the power spectrum of matter, of dark matter, or well, this is actual data of galaxies as a function of k, you see the theory curve is there, this structure of peaks. What's going on is exactly the same. If you have over density or under density in the early universe, there will be a sound wave that radiates from this location at a speed, at whatever is the speed of sound. It will move for the time until recombination, so you will create some distortion whose size is the speed of sound times the age of the universe at recombination. So there's a characteristic scale. If you were to measure the same thing in real space, ask, for example, in the case of galaxies, is the excess probability of finding another galaxy at a given distance from one galaxy that you have, this correlation function, you discover this peak, which is the Fourier transform of this set of peaks here. It's just these 100 megaparsecs is this distance that sound can travel until recombination. And we can calculate the distance it's supposed to be very accurately from knowing the CMB and so on. And so then we use it as a standard ruler to map cosmology and the expansion history of the universe, see where that scale appears in angle and in
I assume you don't want to have a technical question about this.
Yes. Yeah, you can
go on and talk.
As you wish.
Well, I'm noticing this huge trend for the data to be below the line.
Like this, for example?
Yeah.
Yeah, so
and I don't know if those are even correlated.
Right. So one thing to keep in mind is that let me just give you an answer at the very simplistic level, is that if you are in Fourier space, in a completely simplistic way, in which a perfect survey and so on, all these data points would be uncorrelated, okay?
The ones below don't look uncorrelated.
Well, in a real survey, there is some correlation function, but it's smallish. So it's imperfections in the survey, like the boundaries and so on, that creates holes and stuff,
so
creates.
Right, Fourier space.
In Fourier space, you have the signal is in a bunch of peaks. In many, if you want, it's diluted over a bunch of scales, and it's but the data points are all independent. If you do here, the whole thing is just a peak, but there's much bigger correlations, which you can calculate, and it's okay. But for looking at it,
it looks more uncorrelated here than there for a reason.
And it's understood. I mean, in principle, you can get the information from here and there, no problem, it's the same. But I think, this is very easy to understand. Anyway, so this distance is 100 megaparsecs. The width of this feature is, tens of megaparsec, and so it's a very nice. And people have already made measurements of the equivalent of a Hubble diagram, distance versus redshift, using the BAO scale at various redshifts, various experiments. And they plan to do even better in the future. There are many surveys. This is a plot that was shown in the conference here some time ago of some 21 centimeter experiment trying to do this at higher redshift. But just the reason I wanted to show this is just to point to the fact that current error bars, well, maybe you cannot read this very well, but current error bars are at the few percent level. The next generation of experiments want to make this measure at percent or cross the percent level line, okay? That's the kind of precision that you want to attain, or even better if you could. Now, already here, we know that the effects of the nonlinear dynamics is already it's already degrading things or changing things in an appreciable manner. This is a very nice illustration from a paper by Nikhil Padmanabhan and other people. What they did is the following. The claim is that in the initial conditions there is this excess correlation of having some, say, matter or galaxies in this case at some distance. You have some concentration of galaxies here. There is an excess 100 megaparsecs away. Okay, so you just paint, just for the purpose of illustration, paint all the points in the simulation at this distance and let it go. And what you see is that they move around as a result of large-scale structure. Okay, and so now then this very nice 100 megaparsec separation with 10 or whatever megaparsec width is now blurred by these motions produced by large-scale structure. Okay, and things to notice is that compared to the width of the curve, the motions are comparable. They're big. If you look at the they had drawn a little Gaussian, they painted a little Gaussian there, and this is the width of the resultant Gaussian after the large scale structure. So this is significant degradation of how good the standard candle this is. Other thing to notice is that these motions are pretty coherent. You can see that all in this they're dominated by large scales. All of these regions are near, on the one side, a big chunk here is on the outside, so it's dominated by large scales. It's a big separations relative to the width, and it's dominated by the large scale. So that's the inspiration for something called reconstruction that these people and they and others have pioneered, made in the data, used also in the data, and plan to use in the future. What they do is they say, if these motions are produced by gravity, the way we understand it, then we can measure. We are in the same survey. We are measuring the distribution of matter on these large scales. We can infer, using our understanding of the dynamic, what these motions could had been from, and then we move everything back to where it used to, where we think it should have been, and measure now the two-point function of this thing, And this is an example where they did this in this toy model, and you can see that you recover, you take all of those large features out, and you recover a narrower ring. Okay, so you get a better standard candle by doing this, and basically, yes, that's what they are doing. So there's a lot of heuristics here, which I think is there's a place to be improved, and it's part of the things that I was trying to do. But there's a procedure. The procedure works, so maybe it can be improved. Or I'm sure it can be improved. But the other thing at this point that what I wanted to notice is that what you're actually doing basically is taking the measured density contrast, estimating some displacements out of the data, reconstruct some displacements out of the data itself, and move the data by this. So now this, the new density field is some nonlinear transformation on the data that you had, because it's the data evaluated in something that's a function of the data. So it's a nonlinear thing, and then you're measuring a two-point function of some nonlinear transformation of the data.
You're figuring out the delta x by knowing that it has to turn back into a
yeah, so you know that, knowing perturbation theory, you know basically the divergence of this thing is the density field that you measure. And so you invert that, you put it here. So you measure a density field, density contrast on these scales just by counting galaxies. In the in linear theory, the divergence of these motions is the density field, and so you match this way. Then you undo these motions and you measure something. It's along these lines. I mean, it has a little bit of bells and whistles that I don't want to. But
I think the reason you're talking about x is that you're talking about positions of particles.
Yeah, in this case, galaxies. So, they are moving back to galaxies.
So it's not, I mean, it's pretty general. It may be more general than it sounded. I don't know if that was your question. It's not a...
I mean, they're not using that they know initially it was on a spin.
Yeah. No. They just measure the entire density. They figure out at large scales what the motions should have been, and they try to do that. Yeah. This I'm doing as an illustration of saying if what you end up doing, if you want, at the very end, you are measuring some combinations of endpoint functions of the initial data, which have a lot more information about the two-point function of the initial condition than just the two-point function of the final data. Of course, if somebody tells you, you should measure this, and you can do simulations, and you can figure out that it will be a great measurement. But there needs to be some understanding. How are you going to come up with this story if you don't understand what's going on? Okay? I think the main lesson of trying to do in detail, and this is, of course, I'm not inventing it myself, but the main reason to have a good understanding of what's happening and analytical formulas and so on is to discover these kind of things. Okay? You cannot do this by blindly looking into simulation, I think. Then you will, of course, check whatever your invented procedure is, you will check it with the simulation. So basically, I think this is one of the answers to the question that you always get if you're doing this kind of thing. Why do this? You can do the simulations, okay? Just do the simulation. So I think there are a lot of things that you gain. And what is the analog of this thing, not just for the BAO, but if you are interested in the three-point function of the initial density field? Is there some nonlinear transformation that you should be doing to extract a little bit more? All of these questions are very interesting. And we shouldn't all become observers, right? Running n-body simulation is just becoming an observer, and instead of observing the real universe, you observe a fake universe. And we shouldn't all become observers and just do that. So I think it's okay to try to understand things, analytically. I have to, anyway. So let me tell you, I think this, even though there are big successes for an analytical understanding of what's happening on large scales, I think there's a lot of room to, and this has been done for decades and decades, okay? I think there's still quite a bit of room to make an improvement. And so I want to first tell you a little bit about what is being done for those of you that are not doing it on a regular basis. It's not complicated. And tell you what are the clear issues that you see when you're doing this and where, probably should have been noticed forever, and how to fix some of these issues. So what is being done? So the setup is very easy. You are solving, for the most part, we can just do Newtonian gravity. So you're just solving the Poisson equation for the forces. Then you have some sort of fluid. You make up that there's a fluid in the universe made satisfies the continuity equation and the momentum equation, or you can say the universe is made up of a lot of particles, each of which starts at location q, and it moves by some displacement. It satisfies the F equals ma in the expanding universe, and you basically this is a set of nonlinear equations that you solve in perturbation. For example, in this case, you first take all the quadratic terms, you put them to zero, you solve the linear equation, you plug the linear thing back. Trivial, okay? That's what everybody will do. You can do with this set of equations, and it's been done. What the rest that you have to do is you have some stochastic initial conditions. You say you have some initial conditions that have some statistical properties. For each one of these ensemble of these initial conditions, you solve this perturbatively up to a given order, either this or this, and you compute the statistics of the thing at the end. That's the perturbation theory. So you end up with, and this is, if you want to think about it, is for those of you that do in correlations, it's very similar to these kind of things. It's just that instead of being a quantum mechanical thing, it's a classical thing with stochastic initial conditions. So, for example, you can say, I will solve the density field at second order. So I'm here putting the initial conditions. They propagate in time, they interact at some point, and there's the Green's function, same thing at second order. Then you take two of them, you take expectation value, and you can draw a diagram like this, and each of the things is a propagator, an expectation value, you can figure all this out. It's okay, it's easy. There's various kind of terms. You can take one thing just to first order, the other one to third order, and take expectation values like this. They give slightly different answers, but you do this, and basically these loops that you end up doing, what are these loops? They are you're measuring the correlation function, say, on a given scale k, and you're asking the question, what is the influence of modes of different momenta, and taking expectation value of all these modes that you don't observe. And running in this loop, there are modes that are much shorter wavelength than the k that you're interested in, and also much longer wavelength. All of them, you're taking expectation value. That's what you're doing. And the clear problem is that in these loops, so when you do any tree-level calculation, it always gives very nice results for regression theory. But when you're doing any of these loops, when you're taking averages, in these loops are running modes where perturbation theory is not valid anymore, that are in this nonlinear regime, okay? And as a result, the answers that you get are not necessarily correct. So it's not a well-defined procedure. And so you can see this, but it can be made well-defined. You can see this very, you can ask the question of what is the consequence of this in the in our universe, or just take another approach and say, okay, imagine I was running initial conditions, other type of initial conditions with different power laws. So for simplicity, let's consider just initial conditions that are power law as a function of k, the density fluctuations, and vary the index of the power law of the initial conditions, okay? Presumably, this procedure gives answers in every case, and it's okay. No, the answer is no. So what happens? Unless the slope of the power spectrum of the density fluctuations is between -3 and -1, just the one loop calculation diverges, and you can get no answer if you're outside of this range. You can also convince yourself that as you're going to higher loops, this range starts shrinking and shrinking on you. For any n at some order, the whole thing doesn't make any more sense. So it's not something that will converge. But this is just an illustration of the basic point. What is happening? You're putting in, you're in this loop, are running things that you're not solving correctly. For this particular range of scales, you're getting an answer which is infinitely wrong, and so you're getting something completely wrong. But even in the cases, our universe, it's more like close to n to minus 2, equals to minus 2. But there is some mistake for those, and even for the cases that it converges. So what is the size of the mistake? How can we fix the whole thing? Just to make the point, it's not that this range of scales are any, things are outside of this range are anything special. You can run a simulation, no problem, for n equals minus 1 or whatever, and you just, below n equals minus 3 is a problem, but we can discuss. But you can run it, you can get, say, the two-point function, what is the shape of the two-point function divided by the one of linear theory, you can compute it, you can, no problem. However, perturbation theory cannot put anything on this curve, just gives nothing. So what's the story? What's going on? How to fix it? So what is going on is basically when we wrote this down, we made some assumptions. We said, let me back one second. Clearly, if the thing is going to be infinite, if you're getting an infinite answer, somebody's going to save you, okay? So there must be some coefficients that we have not been talking about that will be renorm. You can use it to renormalize the whole story and just get finite answers, okay? But there appears to be no free parameters in this. There appears to be no coefficient that that I can fix. That is the case because I've made this assumption that on large scales this should be described, for example, by a set of or a fluid with no sound speed and no viscosity or no any other properties. Just a perfect. I've just made this assumption. And from where? It's true that microscopically, maybe I think that this is dark matter that doesn't have any sound speed. But it doesn't need to be that the theory that describes in the long wavelength the dynamics of this is the same equations that I think might be valid on the smaller scales. Or equivalently, in the case of the Lagrangian perturbation theory, I've assumed these are particles which have no structure to them. They don't have a quadrupole moment. They don't have any size to them. I made this assumption, but one way of understanding what's going on is that you really should think on the large scales as a theory of a lot of particles of a finite size that have a quadrupole moment and so on. So how can you how can one way of getting to this answer is the following. If you go to sufficiently small scales, we cannot do this calculation perturbatively. So let's start from the very beginning by smoothing take the universe, divide it into little pieces that are big enough that all of the complications of the nonlinear regime are inside of this little piece. Okay, and let's ask the question: what are the equations for the center of masses of these things? And then you will discover that the equations of for the centers of masses of these are not the ones that I wrote down, but these little regions have a quadrupole moment, and all of those terms are the ones that are going to save all of these. So one simple way of realizing this is to actually do this procedure. You start by smoothing the little regions and following the motions of their centers of masses. You can be more sophisticated, but then you discover that the equations for the centers of mass depends, of course, on the quadrupole moment of the region. Okay, it will move differently in the presence of, say, a gravitational potential gradient and so on. If it's big and has some, and it will also source gravity in a different way. It can have a quadrupole, it can have an octopole, etc., etc., etc. So this is now really what we're doing, is an expansion of inderivatives. We are comparing the scale we're interested in with this typical size of these objects, which is the nonlinear scale. Okay, so this is the parameter in this, and you can be a little bit more sophisticated. I mean, this, there's very much of an analogy. People have done much more complicated calculations. People that are interested in emission of gravitational waves, they've done the relativistic version of this. Just if you have, say, black holes, and you first treat them as point particles, and you consistently include all of these things. It's the same story, but non-relativistic, so it's just much easier. And so in such a story, what are the important things? What are the things that enter into the story? Let's just start thinking about the quadrupole, which is all that is going to be important for this talk. So if you have this little region, it has a quadrupole. What you need in order to do the calculation is the following. You need to know if this system is in an external gravitational field, how this quadrupole responds. So the response of the quadrupole to the external gravitational field is one thing that you need to know. And these things that you need to know are not something that we can predict with this perturbation theory. This has to be inputs from, we're basically integrating out the small degrees of freedom. We are solving that. We don't know what the answer of this is. Either we match this to some numerical calculation or we match it to the data. But these unknowns are things that live outside of the perturbation theory, and somebody needs to tell me. And what are they then? Is this response of the quadrupole to tides? I mean, there's a very, there's the response to tides. And then also the small scale dynamics of this might create some deformations of this quadrupole moment, some noise, small scale noise, if you want. From the point of view of the large scales, there's a part of this quadrupole moment that you can predict because it's just the response to whatever the outside field is doing. But then there's a part of the quadrupole moment that has to do with the small scale dynamics that you cannot predict. Yes?
Just a quick question. On the previous slide, it looked like you were moving into the Lagrangian picture primarily. Should we be thinking that way?
We have done it in two ways. We have done it Eulerian, and we have done it Lagrangian. We have not published Lagrangian. We are finishing writing it up. I thought it was easier to. And there's a one-to-one.
It's easier to conceptualize.
It's easier to conceptualize, and I like it much more. And so,
also, the fluid type description ultimately fails.
The fluid. So the fluid type description, you can already complain that when I wrote the fluid description, I said basically the fluid description assumes that at any given point in space there's only one velocity.
Right.
This already fails. Okay. So maybe that was the source, and ultimately. It is the case that the fluid equations are the wrong equations. So eventually, even if I solve perfectly the fluid equations, I'm not reproducing the real system. But that's not the. I think this breaks down on smaller scale. This is it's an effect that happens on the shell, what we call the shell crossing, happens on smaller scales than the breakdown of the. Because the other thing that you do in this perturbation theory is do a perturbation in powers of delta when you. And that becomes one a little bit larger scales. But yeah, I like the Lagrangian thing very much, much better anyway, because it's really simple to understand.
Is it equivalent to doing it in phase space?
I think in some sense Lagrangian is kind of phase space. Yes. The thing is that you really want to do not the theory of point particles, but the theory of extended objects. Because basically what happens, if you are doing point particles, they care about the gradients of the gravitational potential on arbitrarily small scales, which you are not able to compute. So you're going to get their dynamics. So, but a big thing just averages out over the whole. Okay, so these are the kind of things that you need to know, and they need to be told on you from the outside. But you know the structure completely. You know that if this is a response to the tides, it needs to be something that responds to the second derivatives of the gravitational potential. You know how many of these coefficients can be because you can count the indices and so on. So it's completely understood, and it's also understood how big. You can understand very easily how big these effects should be. They depend on these sizes and expansion in derivatives of k times this length scale. So you can count. It's easy. But I think it's important that needs to be, so of course in the examples where the normal answer fails completely because gives infinite, if you don't do this, you can not even put anything on the plot. But even in the cases where it doesn't fail, there's a little bit of this unknown that we better face up to, okay? It's not so small. I mean, it's for precision cosmology. So basically, what ends up happening, for example, at one loop is that in addition to these two standard diagrams that you usually have, you have another new diagram from the response of the quadrupole, which in the cases of where this diverges, it has the exact k dependence and everything correct to absorb all of these problems that you might have. So let me tell you.
That's the question.
Yeah.
Are these always, because it wasn't yes. clear to me whether, are these new counterterms always associated with UV divergences? Are there some cases, you were saying before that sometimes it's wrong, but it doesn't seem to always diverge when it's wrong, so.
The UV part in any, so if we just think, the UV part in any loop, when you're considering modes that are above the nonlinear scale, is always wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. So that part of the contribution now, in the IR of these integrals, we think that the dynamic is captured well by this. It doesn't mean that sometimes there are not IR divergences in these things that in some of these diagrams, but not in the final answer. Those cancel internally, and they are okay.
So you're basically asking whether it's parallel to the, you know, quantum field theory, effective field theory thing. It sounds like you're saying it is. The low energy, or the low, long wavelength stuff is accurately captured.
Yes. I think this is very parallel. Yeah. We are talking about it as if it's completely parallel. There is a big difference, though. In normal effective field theory, when you're integrating things out, whose time dependence is very fast compared to the things that you are keeping. The frequencies of these, they're high momentum modes, they have high frequency there. If you think in a classical way, you have a slowly varying background, you solve the short modes in the presence of this background, they immediately adjust, you plug this back in. This is not the case in cosmology. Because the evolution, even of the short modes, is a Hubble. Everybody evolves with Hubble. So in reality, this separation of scales is just in momentum. Time-wise is not the case. So in reality, we should be ending up with non-local in time things, at least for one Hubble time or so. And it's indeed the case. But OK, I didn't want to go so much. So there is some little differences. I don't know. We haven't yet encountered a situation in which this changes drastically anything, but we are keeping track of it. Maybe we can.
But the Poisson equation is already non-local to start with, so no surprise there.
I meant non-local in time in that it has some sort of memory. The short modes have some sort of memory of, so for example, if I wanted to know some short modes what they are doing now, in a standard situation, if they are very high frequency, they only care about the tides or whatever in the last period or something like this. Here, they only evolve with Hubble, and so they care about the history in the last Hubble, which is the same time scale as the long modes are evolving. So you really cannot, you would have to be a little bit careful with this.
This is the same issue as worrying about secular effects that are somehow building up. So you have a good, for short times, you know you have a good, rigorous, you know, counting of the,
yes,
of the errors because you're, right? But over long times, it could be that a small error grows somehow with time. And that's something, since you're not treating those modes accurately, you don't know whether some short mode effect could be building up over time. Is that?
It's something like this, yes. More. This could be a worry, yes. I mean, we know how these things evolve more or less in time. We have the, it's not a mystery. This is very, but it's not like if I. You can write an action for this, you can do the standard story, integrate that, but then you will not end up with an action necessarily that is local in time. This quadrupole is not just something that you can integrate, it just depends on the modes that you're tracking at this particular time. It depends on the history of it for at least one Hubble time. In this power law universe, let's discuss for a second in this power law universe, then there's only one scale in the length scale in the problem, is the nonlinear scale, the scale where the density contrast is one. And depending, you can start with different initial conditions such that the power spectrum of initial conditions scales as k to some power, some n, okay? And then we know now how to count exactly what are the sizes in powers of k. This then becomes a perturbation in powers of k over k nonlinear, and we know the different terms, what size there are. So for example, at around n equals minus 2, this is how the linear power spec. These curves, each of these curves shows the n scaling. For example, if say it's minus 2, it means that this term goes as k over k nonlinear square, okay? So, and these are different contributions. This is the linear power spectrum, the one loop, the two loop, okay? These are this quadrupole moment, octupole moment, and so on. And this is this noise term, okay? So you can go through and see how they should all scale with k over k nonlinear. And you can see, if you want to do a calculation to a given accuracy, what you need to include, okay? So this can be figured out, and we have figured out. So for example, for n equals minus around minus 2, the one loop correction, the standard one loop correction that people calculate is the first thing that appears, but very close to it is this quadrupole contribution. Then comes the two loop, the second, and so on. Okay. For this n equals minus 1, what's happening is that, in here the one loop correction and the quadrupole term have the exact same k dependence. That is how it can cancel with this divergence that appears, and so on. So from here you can check how everything goes, and you can see where the divergences should appear, for what ends, who's going to cancel, and you can check this at least at one loop, and it all works. So it's very much, it appears to me that indeed thinking of this as the theory of extended objects allows you to understand all that's going on. So now let me show you this is work that Leonardo Senatore sent me. So he is brave and he is going all the way to two loops, okay? And so this is what he's showing here is the comparison of the results from this calculation to some measurements of n-body simulations for the power spectrum of fluctuations. This is k. The error bars already in the measurements themselves are they say 1%, but maybe they're a little bit bigger from the simulations themselves, okay? Now, this just shows the ratio of the results from this calculation to the answer, okay? So if you just do linear theory, it's this curve, okay? If you do one loop SPT, the standard one loop calculation goes like this.
First, I thought you'd put data on this plot.
Yeah, what?
First, I thought you put SPT data.
Oh, no, no. Southpole telescope. No. So this is the standard calculation. And then so the counting in loops is done as if the spectrum in our universe was close to n minus 2, which is more or less the same. So this quadrupole counts as a half a loop, one power of k over k only. So so this goes as k over, in this example, this goes roughly as k over k nonlinear square, q, and so on. And so this now involves fitting. So the first, the message is that, or measurement in the simulation, this will have a fitting parameter, okay? It's impossible, the small scales, you just don't know them. So you better, that's what's gonna happen. So he has one fitting parameter, which is this 0.5 loop, okay? And this gives you this curve. Two loop, he knew, now calculated. 2.5 loop, no more few parameters, no new parameter, because basically that is the same coefficient that he fitted at one loop, but now multiplying one higher term. So he can go all the way to the equivalent to k over k nonlinear to the fifth with one free parameter. So this agreement is based on one free parameter, okay? So the power spectrum, the two-point function of the density field. Okay. So, and for comparison, this is around here is what it's supposed to be, the nonlinear scale. Now, it's not a well-defined statement, the nonlinear scale. In a sense, the nonlinear scale is well-defined if you just say is wherever the density fluctuations in linear theory give you one. But probably a better definition is wherever perturbation theory breaks down and this series will never converge anymore, and you cannot, but this we don't know if it's here or twice as big. It looks like you can keep going, okay? And there's I can show you other evidence that you can keep going in just a second. So much more compelling. It's megaparsecs, inverse megaparsecs, sorry, okay. These are very, I ask him to, so.
Roughly the message here is that all of these orders have roughly the same accuracy, but you're getting good accuracy when they fall off a cliff.
Eventually you will fall off a cliff. I don't know.
Gets delayed significantly by going to higher orders.
We don't know where this will stop really. I don't know. And this has to be done more carefully, I think. But I just but just to point out that in the standard calculation, you barely can, you very quickly just, and if you look at two loop and one loop in the standard calculation without adding this parameter, two loop is just as bad, it's worse, the whole thing is just.
Given that you have these memory effects and so on, how many, is the usual counting of, counter terms, so to speak, irrelevant or irrelevant operators the same, or is it, how many parameters should I expect?
Yes, I can. To one loop, you should expect this one parameter only. To 2.5 loops is where you should expect it's only one parameter. But it's a detail. I need to show you all of these terms, how they scale with k over k nonlinear.
The picture of the action you're using is focusing too much on the memory effects that you discussed before, but it's some integral over time.
Yes.
Extra beyond what we normally would have.
Yes, but that's very nice.
That's what this
is saving us. And in this perturbation theory, the k dependence and the time dependence go separate. And so even though there is really some sort of Green's function that is a free function you want, but it only enters in an integral. So the one free parameter is the size of this integral. The time dependence of these sources factors out, and so you just need to know the result of the time dependence of the source times the Green's function, the integral over time. But it's just it always comes integrated in the same way. That's, I guess, maybe the easiest. It appears integrated always with the same time integral. So even though it looks like a free function, it boils down to one free number. Though if we were doing this at different redshifts, the number would be different. Not in the scaling universe. In the scaling universe, we would know from one redshift and every redshift what the answer should be. But in our universe, this free parameter, you could think of it as depending on the final time you're doing the calculation, one free parameter that could be Probably it's not a dramatic function, but it's a,
so wait, time can mean on a light cone where, I mean, we observe different times.
Yes.
But is it still just one function if based on our...
I think we're
at one, it's kind of one time, right? In the right.
Yeah, so for example, if it were just always the matter era, then yes, it's easy.
Even though we observe things where there's different ratios of dark energy to...
Yeah, then this is the reason why if I wanted to do the computation, I'd say for redshift 1 and redshift 0, that these two the number here, the free parameter, I now have some leeway to them, because now if there was always the matter error, I wouldn't have any
leeway. Really matter.
That's what I meant. So because of this reason, but I think if we think a little bit harder, we can
probably... What are you going to do about that to apply this?
These numbers, we eventually will have to discuss all of the complications of observing galaxies and so on. But if we step back, then these numbers are completely calculable from the simulation. I don't need to feed it to, I mean, this is a Green's function, I can compute. Yeah. But I just need to extract from the simulation one number. It should not change, yes. So, of course, tests are much less at this point than I would like. But okay, I can convince many of you to work on this, and we will have all of these tests very quickly.
A more vague version of the same sort of question. I mean, in normal relativistic field theory of one scalar field, you'd say, you know, you can count your relevant parameters.
Yes.
But here you don't have relativistic symmetry.
No.
You might think you'd have sort of more relevant parameters.
So the one...
UV theory, and yet you only have one, so I'm trying to...
No, I have one because I've stopped at this 2.5 loops. Let me go back. For example, this is how it scales as a power of k over k nonlinear, the one loop, the linear theory, one loop, two loop, etc. Okay? Three loop will be like this, okay? This is how the first parameter in the one scales. This is our second parameter. So if I am here, I compute two loops. If I want to have even better accuracy, I will need to go to the octopole and so on, a better power than k. But it depends on where you want to stop. We know the counting of this it depends how accurate you want to go. If you want to be more accurate, you will need to have more parameters. But it's not... an infinite number. I mean, if you want infinite accuracy, there's a lot of parameters as far as we can understand, but it's very well organized. But for example, before you need this parameter, you need to do a three loop calculation. So, okay, first somebody needs to do the three loop before I include this. So, and these parameters are just numbers also. There's a k dependence to them that is fixed. And they enter in the velocity, in the density, they enter in a bunch of places. I'm just showing you one, but it's just one parameter that is allowed to give you a lot of things. Okay. But in any case, whether you like it or not, this is a fact, right? So, of the universe, yeah.
You could test this in infinitely many other observables if you would do the 2.5 loop or whatever calculation.
Yes, it's always the same parameter, exactly. So all of these things, I completely agree. And we are slowly building ourselves to do these kind of things. Enrico is doing velocity things, other people 3.5, I don't know. Okay. But we are not so many. I mean, So let me tell you about something else about this perturbation theory that I find a little bit annoying about what the. Which is that this perturbation theory, it does not organize things according to their size, okay? This loop expansion that I told you is a complete wrong, in my opinion, wrong-headed organization of this series. Why? Let me give you examples, okay? This is the baryonic acoustic oscillations, the peak there, and here's the linear theory peak. this is the result of linear theory, this is the result of the simulation. You can see a big effect, okay? You can see it with your eyes. Now, if you ask the question, how big are the tides over a distance of 100 megaparsecs? The correlation function squared, which is the delta on that scale, which is over density on that scale, which is the naive thing that you're using to count how big the effects are, and that's what you think you're doing. It's 10 to minus 3 on this scale. Clearly, this is an effect much bigger than 10 to the minus 3. So inside of a bunch of, course, we all understand the people where this is coming from is these motions of 10 megaparsecs. It's affecting something that has a width of a similar width. So we understand. We know where it's coming from. But we still organize the perturbation theory. My point is not that we don't understand what is going on, but that we still organize the perturbation theory and keep terms, some of which are 10 to the minus 3. Some of them are tens of percent. They are being counted as if they were the same. Okay? And so when I keep just, and people would just say one loop, or just one of these parts, some of them is an effect 10 to the minus 3, another one is an effect of 10%. The next order, does it have an effect of only, if it's 10% squared, is a percent? Okay? Am I missing things that are big in the next term? What is going on? Okay, this is cut off. But and are there things in between? What is the actual parameter? What is going on? How is it possible? Okay, there's some other evidence that this is there are clearly, but let me skip because I'm right. So it's very clear that things are being counted in the wrong way. Okay. Or they're inside of this perturbation theory, there are things that are much bigger than others, and they are being treated as the same. So let me try to tell you what are these different parameters that I think we should start keeping them separate. Okay. Let's just do by inspection. The easiest thing is just to do by inspection of the different terms that appear in the one loop calculation, in the standard one loop calculation. And you will see that various integrals over the power spectrum appear with different powers of the momentum. Okay, so it's an integral over momentum Q that's running in the loop. Okay, sometimes it's the power spectrum divided by Q squared. This thing is just the typical displacements of things. And then the k, so this is the wave number that you're looking at compared to the displacement that things, how much things are moved, the RMS displacement of things that are moved. These are things that enter. These are the displacements produced. If you think of a mode k, you can think of modes q's that are longer than larger scale or smaller scales. Okay, and various things appear in perturbation theory. Like for example, the comparison between k and the mode and the displacement produced by modes that are much shorter, much longer wavelength than it, much shorter wavelength than it, and also the tides produced by modes that are much longer than it. So the delta on these scales, the delta on the small scales doesn't really appear, because even if you change the, you only care about the mass. If you just change a lot of density here and empty there from the point of view of large scale, it doesn't matter. So the density fluctuations on the small scales do not enter. These quantities are, and everybody knows this, they're dominated by completely different ranges of scales. So these are the plot. This is the power spectrum of delta. I'm not discovering anything new, but you can see that the higher the k, the more fluctuations there are. This is the power spectrum of the velocity, which is what sets the displacements. It peaks on large scales. So these integrals are dominated even by different range of scales. So they are completely independent parameters. And the problem is that we are counting them all as the same, and they are completely not the same. That some lead to effects that are order 10%, some for the BAO, some lead to effects that are a tenth of a percent. Okay, so and the other interesting thing is that some of these parameters are trivially summed to all orders, if you want. So for example, the motions produced by modes that are much larger than the ones that, so these are coherent motions of things, velocities that are almost constant. Of course, this does nothing to the dynamics, just move things around. So this is not even, it's a nonlinear effect, it's coupling of the modes, but it's trivial. And this is what this Lagrangian perturbation theory works so much better, because it's adding all powers of these, okay? And you really want to do it, because if you just plotted if you just plotted these epsilons, the motions from modes that are longer than the k of interest, this is the plot as a function of k. It's big, big. This epsilon is not an epsilon, okay? It's a big thing. So this, you really want to add this all up. This is why you want to do this Lagrangian in Lagrangian space. But between the, this is the power of the delta, this is of the thing that is creating this quadrupole distortions, the motions from modes that are smaller than you, the actual motions. This one is bigger than this, okay? So really, we are counting on some ranges of scales, we should be just focusing on this. On some ranges of scales, on small scales, we should be focusing on that. And there is some cutoff somewhere here in which the theory breaks down, and everything that we are thinking that is happening here needs to be replaced by three parameters that we need to fix. Okay? So this is kind of the, we need to reorganize this, and that's what we have been trying to do, and I had some typical orders of magnitude, but let me, and it's clearly not obvious. And in fact, if you want to go below 1% for this, there are things that were there are in orders that are not being taken into consideration that are not so small because they are powers of one of these epsilons like here, as opposed to, so naively, the scale of the BIO is over here and you're doing powers of epsilon. This epsilon, you know, is so small that who cares about it. But in reality, the mixing of the scales is really, some of these loops are really counting powers of this epsilon at a significantly higher k, which is not a small factor. And so some of the terms that are, I think we need to investigate them more carefully. Okay, so we've been using this for various things, but let me jump to the end. So I think there's substantial room for doing things a little bit more carefully in this large scale structure and not taking the attitude that we'll come up with a formula and the truth is to just compare with the simulation. And if it's better, we are okay. And if it's not better, I don't know. Let's find whatever is better. That's not, I don't think, a particularly good attitude, because it's really, if you're going to do that, then what's the point? I mean, you just run the simulation. If you're, every time you need to compare with the simulation, we need to understand the errors, okay? And I think there's a lot of room, and we have to demand that if you're doing this calculation, you get an answer that is finite for every n. Things that are obvious, it needs to be demanded, and I think there's quite a bit of room. And I think once we have this under control, I think we should start asking these other questions and perhaps move eventually to things that are more complicated, like the effects of variance and so on. I'm sure those are much more complicated. I doubt that one can get the same kind of precision, okay? But I'm not so sure that an organizational principle like this one that can tell you exactly what you don't know, how it scales over, cannot be achieved in this case as well. I'm sure it can be, and at least we should be able to figure out from, you know, what kind of mistakes we have or how many parameters we should measure. And people have phenomenologically done some of these things. But I think there's quite a bit of room, and I hope I convince some of you to start looking into this more carefully. Okay, thank you.
So, effective field theories often, when we write our EFT, the first thing they talk about is what's the power counting rule.
Yes.
Because you want to know what's the rule to estimate the different sizes.
Yeah.
So. Do you have something like
that? Yeah, and that's the reason I was able to show you this how the different terms go is because we think we know. I mean, this is a derivative expansion. There is a length scale associated with these quadrupoles that is the nonlinear, is related to the nonlinear scale. So each time you add a quadrupole, an octupole, and blah, 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 this counts as one. The case usually come a square power, so k over k nonlinear square to the fourth, so we know exactly, and then the loops we also know, so that we understand. Yes, that's.
But then when you have that, does that allow you to write down all the counter terms that you need?
Yes, yes, yes. In fact, I can show you some draft. We have, yeah, we can write them all out. Yes, and in fact, one of the you can just take this most general theory of extended objects coupled to gravity that people have written down for the black holes, take the non-relativistic limit, and this is exactly what we are doing. I didn't present it this way because it's just...
But then it sounds like you're done, right? The rest is just doing the calculation.
Yeah, and this is what we are paid for, doing the calculation. No, but you know, there are subtleties like the non-locality there is the non-locality in time. It's slightly different because of this.
But does that give you new divergence structure?
I don't think it gives you new divergence structure, but I mean, we are just starting. Okay, so I don't think so, but I will eventually come back to you when we get to this. There are some other hidden. I'm interested in getting to some detail of the calculation. So, I mean, the answer now we know there is a path to get to the answer, but I haven't yet lost interest. So, there's another thing. If you think of this power law universe, for example, it's true the only thing with units of length is the nonlinear scale. But there are parameters of order one, the size of that will probably make the size of this object smaller than the nonlinear scale. Because gravity, what it's doing is sticking everything together, okay? So the thing collapses and becomes smaller. So there is probably some hierarchy between some of these terms, the ones that come from the multiples and the one that come from delta, that makes, I'm guessing, makes the ones of the multiple converge faster. And this probably depends on the slope of the power spectrum. It's a numerical a thing of order one. It's not a parametric difference, but I'm still, for example, interested in trying to figure that out from the simulations and things like this. So I think there's still some questions. Yeah.
So we're used to thinking about, so nonlinearities grow with time, right, in our universe. So in some way, this is a short time expansion. You can only follow these nonlinearities so far. And I get, but the way you're talking about it is some expansion in scale.
Yes, because
the matching is that these different scales become nonlinear.
Yes, at different times. So for example, in the scaling universe, where if you have a matter error in just power law initial conditions, everything is self-similar, and so you can do at a given time of expansion of k over k nonlinear, and just another time you just relabel the k, and you know exactly how.
So is it then possible that there are actually some things that are actually just mildly nonlinear today,
where you can get
an accurate treatment of them analytically, and you could actually.
Yeah, this is, so as you go to lower in the K over K, that's the, yeah, exactly, yeah, that's true. So we are not trying, yeah. But also, it's not this place where this nonlinear scale really should be defined as the place where we lose the ability to do a calculation, where this series really does not converge. We don't know where, I mean, we know roughly speaking where it is, but a factor of two is a lot. It's 8 times more. So, and we just don't know how this depends on cosmology, for example. We just don't know. And if you're just coming up with some approximate formula and comparing with simulation, you never know if your agreement is just by luck or what's the story. Who knows? Now you need to try to understand this in more detail, and not just compute. And another thing that we have been doing is not just compute statistics like this, but actually take all the phases and everything. Take a box and see how it looks computed with the perturbation theory to some order, and how it looks computed. Maybe I'll show this graph just. And how it looks computed with the n-body simulation. And this is just, if you do the most naive thing, which is just you move the particles with this what's called the Seldovich approximation, just the linear theory solution. Just let's look how well the linear theory is doing. You just take a box, you evolve it with this linear theory solution in the Lagrangian space. This is very important, and you compare with the final answer in the n-body simulation, and you just do the correlation coefficient between the two. If something has correlation coefficient in one, means they are identical up to an overall normalization. Okay. So this is the plot of the correlation coefficient, which is something that goes between 0 and 1. 1 is identical, okay, up to a factor, between the nonlinear thing and what you get from, say, just Seldovich. And it's this curve, okay? This is this is the supposed nonlinear scale. And so Lovich is able to calculate all the phases and everything. I think the correlation coefficient is 0.95, 0.97 or something like this. So clearly this is not the nonlinear scale, because even the linear theory is telling me exactly everything that's happening to, so for example, this is another illustration. If I do the second order in Lagrangian space, and I ask the question, what is the residual there? What is in terms of the power, or in terms of the size of the fluctuation, the residuals that I cannot predict compared with the what is the size compared with the full answer, the ratio of the power spectrum? At the nonlinear scale is 1%. So clearly, this definition of the nonlinear scale is bogus. Okay, I mean it's a definition, but clearly I can do much better than this. How much better? I don't know. And this is the reason this curve was going above K nonlinear. So clearly, I mean I don't understand this completely, but this is a fact because it's easy to measure it. But we need to understand it better, no?
You know, if any of the Condor terms break the symmetry of the original tree level equation of motion.
Which symmetry?
So suppose Rialto wrote a paper in February or something,
yes,
enumerating the general symmetry of those classical equations you wrote down initially.
Yes.
Do you know if any of the Condor terms break those symmetries?
I don't know. I mean, the obvious things like momentum conservation, these are not, but I don't know what other symmetries. Yeah, I haven't looked at it there, but I don't know.
Yeah. So just saying, the coefficient that you get from fitting to simulations, that depends on the cosmological parameters, right?
Yes.
So is there a possibility of getting some sort of smooth function where you can determine how the coefficient changes as a function?
Yes, definitely.
And
but we haven't
have
done it. We yet have not done it. But yeah, and it should not be this coefficient. You get, so if you ask the question, how well can you determine this coefficient? This coefficient is not a stochastic thing. It doesn't depend on realization or mode by mode. This is basically the, you know, it's so for example, the only error that you get in determining this coefficient is from the part of the fluctuations that you cannot predict. So of these scales, the noise even for one mode is like 1%. So you can make completely very good determinations of this in the simulations, no problem. This is easy to measure in the simulation. So we should be able to do how it does. It depends on cosmology, how it depends on time in the non-scaling universe where this is an issue that we don't know. Yeah, we have a lot of things to do. Okay, thank you.